Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Charles Geyer for an update of the current and planned breast cancer trials of the NSABP, and he began our conversation by commenting on a new study focusing on neoadjuvant systemic therapy of triple-negative breast cancer.
B48 will be a trial that's going to actually look at a couple things. It's a 2x2 design that is going to be targeting women with essentially triple negative breast cancer. The primary tumor must be 2 centimeters or greater, unless they have palpable axillary nodes that are biopsy proven to be involved with metastatic cancer. In that case, they can come on even if the primary is less than 2 centimeters. And that has to be with FNA and core. Strictly speaking, patients can get on with ER-PR negative or ER-PR weakly positive, and we're lining our eligibility criteria up to match the new ASCO CAP guidelines. So basically, less than 10% of cells positive by IHC will be viewed as weakly positive, so those patients will be included. And importantly, those patients are being included in BIPAR's phase 3 metastatic trial, so we wanted to have consistency there. The regimens that we are evaluating, we're using a standard control regimen of weekly paclitaxel times 12, followed by AC for 4 cycles, and comparing that with a non-anthracycline regimen of taxotere-cytoxan times 4, followed by the carboplatin-gemcitabine combination that Joyce and her colleagues used in their phase 2 study and that's being carried forward into the phase 3 trial. And so those are the 2 chemotherapy options, and then each chemotherapy option is plus minus eniparib.
Or a BSI 201, as we heard originally with Joyce's presentation.
Right. It's been referred to as BSI 201, but it has its proper name now.
So this is a straightforward neoadjuvant study. I guess it's a follow-up to the B40 study that looked at different chemo regimens alone or with Bev.
Correct. And B40 just finished accruing in June, so we're hoping for a short period where we don't have a neoadjuvant trial for our women with palpable HER2-negative breast cancer.
Can you provide an update of where we are in terms of eniparib and PARP inhibitors in general and what your thinking was in putting this study together?
Well, the preclinical work on PARP1 inhibition as a potential target to augment chemotherapy in women with triple negative or ER-poor breast cancers has been around a while, and there are, of course, a number of companies that are developing compounds. BIPAR was, I think, more aggressive in quickly moving their drug into randomized trials and worked with Joyce O'Shaughnessy and her group to do the randomized phase 2 study that had those striking results that she presented at ASCO. I guess that was 2009. And that really jumped that compound substantially ahead of the other compounds. I know one of the problems that has slowed down the development of the other compounds is there seemed to be some synergistic toxicity with chemotherapy with a number of the other PARP inhibitors that, for some reason, is clearly not there with eniparib. I think a lot of people are trying to understand that. You know, I hear some investigators wonder, well, is it even inhibiting the same target? And so there are a number of questions. But, you know, our perspective was that while Joyce's study was not definitive and the phase 3 trial clearly needed to be conducted, it was reasonable to move the compound into a neoadjuvant setting where you can quickly determine efficacy based on PCR.
This study design, as always with the NSABP, is really interesting. What about afterwards? Is any post-op chemo or any systemic therapy?
No, we were going to just limit the treatment to the time they were receiving chemotherapy.
Now, I know at one point there was discussion of looking at this agent in the post-neoadjuvant setting for people who had residual disease. At one point, you were looking at sunitinib. Why did you decide to bring it into the neoadjuvant setting, and are you thinking about anything in the post-neoadjuvant setting?
Yeah, our idea for the post-neoadjuvant trial was that frequently there appear to be particularly targeted agents that are being developed that look like they might have activity by themselves and could be problematic combining with chemotherapy. So we thought the patient population with post-neoadjuvant residual disease was an appropriate group to try to evaluate that type of agent. We had initially written a study to evaluate sunitinib in this patient population, but As I think everyone's aware, the data in breast cancer, as it unfolded, really became less and less supportive of a trial. And so we decided not to open the trial based on the other data and kind of hold that group out for a subsequent study. And certainly Inipirib is a compound that one might consider for that situation. And I believe that Joyce O'Shaughnessy and some other groups are considering going ahead with Inipirib. Our feeling was that since we had the B40 study completing accrual, and the clear exciting data for this agent was given concurrently with chemotherapy, and it was so well tolerated, it made sense to move it up into that situation where you get that early activity signal from your PCR, as opposed to a post-neoadjuvant where you have to wait for recurrent events that could take years. So we felt like the data was strong enough, in a sense, to jump this into the neoadjuvant setting, and so that's the reason for the design. Obviously, this compound's not going to move forward if the metastatic phase 3 trial doesn't confirm the phase 2 data, but assuming we see that, I think if we did see a substantial increase in PCR rates, then I think that will be something that people will consider. Our B48 study, since it's a 2x2 design, it will have 540 patients. And if there was a very large effect with the Inipirib, we could hazard a 0.65 or less with sufficient follow-up. We could see those long-term endpoints as well. Now, there are secondary endpoints in the trial, so they wouldn't be definitive, of course, from a design or regulatory perspective. We have been talking with CTEP as well as the company about considering the possibility of expanding this into a more traditional adjuvant design. Basically, if we are seeing high PCR activity, then, you know, select that chemotherapy regimen and go ahead and continue to accrue neoadjuvant patients as well as adjuvants. So you would, in essence, then be able to convert it to a more traditional adjuvant endpoint such as IDFS. This approach is something that's, I think, people have been talking about for a number of years, trying to get more efficient with trial development and moving compounds through. And there are some hurdles to be overcome, but this is a study where I think that becomes at least a possibility that I think warrants consideration.
So you're not going to actually pull the trigger on the study till you see the phase 3 metastatic study?
No. You were asking me, you know, in terms of this changing practice, and I was saying I don't think this in and of itself would. But no, we feel like the phase 2 data was sufficient that we're willing to go ahead. And again, very importantly, the lack of apparent additive toxicity of the compound, you know, it's been looked at with multiple agents. We are delaying activation until later this year until some preliminary data becomes available combining Inipirib with anthracycline. And there's some ongoing pilot studies that everyone agreed we should let those get completed, but we're still looking for a fourth quarter activation for this trial.
Any thoughts about whether this agent might have activity in non-triple negative situations and whether there are any tissue predictors out there? We saw some data presented first in Europe and then at ASCO by Dr. Gunter van Makowitz looking at an IHC stain for PARP. Of course, that wasn't in a PARP inhibitor trial, but do you think in the long term these agents might be helpful in select non-triple negative patients?
I think the data is interesting. It basically suggests that even the non-triple negative tumor cells frequently seem to have increased PARP1 activity. The question will be in those tumor types is how central is that to the tumor's activity and survival. So, you know, I think it certainly warrants evaluation in those populations, but I think it would be best to do those in separate trials.
Let's talk about trials in HER2 positive disease. What about the neoadjuvant study? I think it's B41. Could you review the design for that and where we are right now?
Sure. B41 is a study that is evaluating lapatinib versus the combination of lapatinib, trastuzumab with the control arm of trastuzumab. The chemotherapy backbone in our trial was the same backbone from the B31, N9831 studies, AC times 4 followed by weekly paclitaxel times 12. And there's three arms. One group of patients start trastuzumab with paclitaxel. Another group receives lapatinib with paclitaxel, and the third group gets trastuzumab and lapatinib with the paclitaxel. After the 12 weeks of paclitaxel-based therapy, patients go on to surgery and we assess PCR. Following surgery, all patients then receive Herceptin to complete a year of targeted therapy. We elected not to administer the year of targeted therapy with lapatinib, but focus it on the neoadjuvant interval.
And where are you right now?
Right now, we've accrued, the target sample size is 522 patients, and we've accrued 353. We did have it designed for our DMC to look at our PCR rates after the first half of the patients had completed their neoadjuvant therapy and had surgery, so our DMC will be seeing the interim results in October, so we'll see. We were looking, though, to see PCR rates increase from approximately 40% up to the mid-60% range with the combination. So it would have to be a pretty robust activity to cross an interim boundary.
Yeah, I guess in a sense, you're testing out what's being looked at in the adjuvant setting with a so-called ALTO trial.
Right, and NEO-ALTO was conducted as part of the main ALTO trial. And my understanding is that NEO-ALTO may be reporting at San Antonio. So I think the combination of the two targeted agents is clearly of great interest.
Obviously, there's a lot of excitement about the possibility of the combination. We've seen some clinical reports, we've seen some translational reports, you know, suggesting maybe the possibility of synergy. What are you doing right now in your own practice outside a protocol setting in terms of the combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib? We had the JCO paper in the presentation showing a survival advantage. I think a lot of people are kind of scratching their heads trying to figure out where it fits in. Outside of protocol right now in your own practice, where does it fit in?
Well, that report that you mentioned, you know, showing the survival data, I mean, again, the design of that was taking women who had refractory disease to trastuzumab and randomizing them to cross over to full dose lapatinib versus the attenuated dose of lapatinib that's necessary to continue trastuzumab. And when you look at the design of that study, it looks like the deck is stacked in favor of lapatinib. But the remarkable thing is that in that very heavily pretreated advanced population, that combination, as you said, resulted in improved survival, which I think is remarkable. And that has impacted a great deal on the way I practice. I find myself using trastuzumab, lapatinib together to give patients some time off chemotherapy with the dual targeting agents. And I think the studies do comment about fatigue. I have seen that. I think you do run into, it seems like patients over time on lapatinib start to have nail bed changes. But, you know, those are problems that happen out there after 8, 12 months. And so I think those are the kind of side effects that one's willing to work with for the benefit. So I have begun using it. The thing I really struggle with is, do I use lapatinib with capecitabine or do I use lapatinib with trastuzumab? Obviously, since I had the good fortune of being the lead on the capecitabine lapatinib study, it's an interesting dilemma. But when I look at the activity of the combination with trastuzumab as well as the tolerance, I find myself going to that first.
You know, and it also brings up the question of capecitabine trastuzumab. What about that combination outside of protocol setting earlier on?
I think it's a very reasonable combination. I mean, there are so many options now for treating HER2-positive breast cancer, both because of the choices you have with the chemotherapeutic agents as well as the targeted agents, that it's really getting increasingly difficult to describe the way that I treat HER2-positive patients. An advantage, of course, of the capecitabine is that it is something that offers activity against CNS disease, which is a big problem for women with metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer. And so we don't really have evidence that that combination somehow results in fewer downstream CNS events, but that would be, realistically, that would be a very difficult study to ever pull together and conduct. But I think it's not an unreasonable thing to think that there might be some benefits there for patients. Certainly once patients have CNS metastases documented, I think lapatinib and capecitabine both become very important considerations, particularly since we have patients who, after their first metastatic disease with their CNS, can sometimes go years with their CNS disease.
So in the adjuvant setting, of course, you all are doing the so-called BETH study with the BCRG, looking at the addition of bevacizumab to chemotrastuzumab, mainly TCH. When do you think accrual is going to be completed? What are you thinking about in terms of the next adjuvant study? And I know you all must be talking about T-DM1 at some point.
Yeah, BETH is a trial that we're conducting as a collaborative effort with a CIRG, and accrual to that trial is really going very well. The targeted sample size was 3,500 patients, and as of Monday morning, we had 2,900 patients. We're currently accruing 200 a month, so we anticipate closure of that by the fourth quarter of this year.
Can I just ask, obviously you don't have efficacy data, but at one point there were concerns about the heart in terms of adding bevacizumab on top of chemotrastuzumab. I'm assuming you've been looking at that all along, and so far it's not being a problem?
Yeah, the trial was designed to allow us to get information on the dual antibody in combination with anthracycline information. So the investigators, and in fact, CIRG and NSABP both made the decision that our chemotherapy regimen on the trial was going to be the carbotaxotere with the trastuzumab as our base regimen, and that was going to be plus minus the bevacizumab. We have also, though, included an arm that this is a study that independent investigators around the world are also participating in who are not affiliated with either group. And those investigators can choose between the TCH versus an anthracycline regimen. And our anthracycline regimen in the trial is taxotere for 3 cycles, followed by FEC for 3 cycles, where they get the targeted therapy with the taxotere, but then break during the anthracycline. And it looks like we're probably going to have somewhere around 6-7% of patients will have the anthracycline. So that'll be several hundred. So we will have data. And we are monitoring that. To date, we've not seen problems there, but we are relatively early into the study for those patients because those are the investigators who have come on last into the accrual process.
So what are you all thinking about in terms of the next study?
Well, as you said, the drug that everyone would love to get their hands on is T-DM1, and I know that many groups are looking at that. Things are up in the air right now as to, you know, how and when T-DM1 will enter adjuvant trials.
You know, I think a lot of people think about, of course, efficacy. Obviously, you're trying to cure people. But also, you know, there's been so much controversy about management of the patient with a small node negative HER2 positive disease that, you know, at least if we saw similar efficacy of T-DM1 to chemotrastuzumab, you know, from a toxicity point of view, it seems like it'd be a lot easier to pull the trigger on T-DM1.
Yeah, from what I understand and what the toxicity profiles, that would be an easier passage, so to speak, for the patient because, you know, it doesn't have the alopecia and it's remarkably well tolerated, particularly with shorter durations of administration. I think to me, a question that I'm still not clear on is, you know, is it chemotherapy or is it targeted therapy? So do they need it for a full year or do you give the T-DM1 as a substitute for chemotherapy and then finish off with trastuzumab? Lots of questions to be answered. The thing I have, trastuzumab is so remarkably well tolerated as monotherapy that it's a hard thing for me to, I guess, give up.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Actually, I always thought that it'd be T-DM1 short term and then trastuzumab, you know, out to a year, but you're right. Maybe you just only need to give the T-DM1.
But there's always the question about, do you try and administer T-DM1 for a year? Because my understanding is that there are patients now starting to be on T-DM out that long, seemingly tolerate it. So it's that's what I say. There's a number of very important design questions that are going to have to be figured out. And I think there's still uncertainty about that.
And then right in the middle of this, hopefully we'll have some results from ALTO and BETH. And if either or both of those studies are positive, it's going to get even more complicated.
Yeah, your control arm just got very, very complex. And then the other reality in this, of course, is pertuzumab as a way of potentiating trastuzumab activity. So it's right in the middle of the T-DM1 development. And so it really produces quite a complex scenario that I think is going to take some time to sort out.
Yeah, and Kathy Miller presented some data, early data, just looking at the combination of pertuzumab and T-DM1, which is another interesting thought.
Correct, yeah.
What about the B46 study, so-called tic-tac-toe study? Can you review the design of that and where we are with that?
Sure. B46 is our adjuvant trial for HER2 negative patients, high risk node negative and node positive. This is a study that we are doing jointly in collaboration with U.S. Oncology. And the design of this specific trial is to compare TAC for 6 cycles versus TC for 6 cycles versus TC with bevacizumab. And our sample size for the trial is 3,900 patients. To date, we've accrued 885. The way the specific study is designed is we're looking for a hazard of 0.75 with TCB relative to the TC to see what Bev adds. If Bev adds to the TC, then of course we'll have to turn around and compare that with the TAC to see if the Bev is providing greater benefit than the anthracycline, because that will immediately become a question given the cost, the relative cost of the two drugs. So that's the main endpoints of our trial. However, the important thing that our trial is going to do is when we accrue the 3,900 women, we'll have 1,300 women who receive TAC, 1,300 women who receive TC, and those will be combined with approximately 1,300 women that U.S. Oncology had previously accrued to their TIC-TAC study. And we pre-specified that all those patients are going to be pooled together, so there'll be 3,900 patients randomized in two studies combined to really look at non-inferiority of TC versus TAC. So this trial is going to get a number of important pieces of information, so we're excited about this study.
Couple of questions about endocrine therapy. First, an update on the B42 study looking at 5 versus more than 5 years of endocrine therapy. Can you review the design of that? I think it's closed now. And when do you think we might see some results?
Sure. B42 was a trial that randomized women who were completing 5 years of predominantly AI-based adjuvant endocrine therapy to receive letrozole or placebo. Patients could have gone through the tamoxifen to aromatase inhibitor transition. We did not specify a choice of the aromatase inhibitor. They could have had anastrozole, letrozole, exemestane, whatever, to enter the study. And interest in this trial was tremendous. And we finished accrual ahead of schedule. And in the last month, I think there were like 260 patients entered in the last month. So we finished accruing to this study earlier this year. Because this is a group of women who have a relatively low event rate, it will take time now until we have sufficient events to analyze the data, but we completed the accrual ahead of schedule, so hopefully that'll speed up information from the trial.
Where are things right now in terms of Soonpeg's provocative data from the B31 adjuvant trastuzumab study you all did, in which he reported that patients with HER2 normal tumors actually benefited from trastuzumab? I know there was this, quote, round robin with other pathology labs that was going to be done looking at the same tissue. And the last time you and I talked, you told me the findings were confirmed in the round robin. Is that being published? And are you moving forward with the B47 trial of chemotrastuzumab in patients with HER2 normal tumors?
Yes, it did confirm Soon's finding. No, it has not yet been published. Soon is actively working on that manuscript. The other information is that we now have, you know, several more years of follow-up on B31. And so with those extra events, we've gone back to look to see if there's been any change in information. And the interesting thing about that additional look is that it's appearing like messenger RNA may actually be predictive for benefit from trastuzumab. Initially, when we looked, there was sort of a trend, but it wasn't statistically significant. We had already seen that FISH didn't predict, IHC didn't predict, so we sort of had messenger RNA wasn't conclusive, so it looked like nothing was predictive. But now with more events, that seems to be firming up. Soon's working on that because we want to get all that kind of published together as a unit, but we're hoping to get that submitted within the next few months.
So this is quantitative mRNA?
Yes.
And I also had heard, again, I think it was you, that IHC0 was not going to be in the B47 trial?
Yeah, and the reason, you know, initially when it looked like, well, okay, nothing is predicting IHC, FISH, MRA, none of that predicts. If you're going to do it, then why would you limit it to these 1+, 2+ patients? There's the argument about it's very difficult to discern between 0 and 1+, you know, a number of things. And we had sort of thought, yeah, in view of all that, maybe we should make it a broader eligibility. With this mRNA information evolving with additional follow-up, we've, I guess, swung back to the original position that we are going to go ahead and look for patients that have been identified as IHC 1 plus or 2 plus who are FISH negative to enter the trial. So not throw it open to all to IHC 0 patients, but focus on this group for this initial effort.
Actually, I just thought of another trial I want to ask you about, which is the Taylor X study looking at Oncotype DX in patients with node negative disease. I know you're very much involved with that. Where are we with that right now, and what kinds of discussions are going on within the NSABP in terms of what else maybe to look at with Oncotype, neoadjuvant, node positive? Where are you with all that?
Yeah, well, the Taylor X trial will be completing its accrual within a few months. I mean, the interest in the trial has been really tremendous, and Joe Sperano and ECOG are doing a great job of leading that trial. So it's going to be completed very, very soon. I know SWOG has been wanting to follow up on the 8814 data to do a Taylor X-like trial in women with node-positive ER breast cancer, and you know, I understand that they are continuing to try to move that process forward. So I think that will be very interesting to see, you know, if they are successful in finding the funding and getting that study actually up and running. Then it'll be interesting to see what will be the investigator-patient buy-in. I mean, clearly it would be a very interesting trial to complete and analyze, but I think that's clearly in the works as a replacement, as a possible replacement for Taylor X, but that's being led by SWOG. Some of our surgeons on our breast committee, Harry Baer and a few others, are interested in perhaps developing a B40 replacement for the ER-positive patients, trying to perhaps use the Oncotype DX recurrence score in the decision-making process. So we're in very early stages of wrestling with that design and thinking about how that trial might be conducted.
So that would be in the neoadjuvant
That would be
setting.
A neoadjuvant trial.
And
right.
I guess, yeah, because you wonder about that. I know Luca Gianni had looked at some data on that, but it kind of makes sense. I mean, biologically, that, you know, if you had a patient with a very low recurrence score, I mean, which kind of connotes higher ERPR, that maybe chemo is going to be very beneficial. Is that your take?
Yeah. I mean, you would sort of broadly expect that your PCR rates would be highest in the patient group where chemo benefits were the largest in the adjuvant setting, so that, you know, the high recurrence score intermediate, and Luca's data was certainly consistent with that. And I think the challenge of developing a neoadjuvant trial really gets down to, well, you know, are you going to use the trial to determine if you're going to give chemotherapy or endocrine therapy? If you're going to give endocrine therapy, then does that mean that you're not going to give chemotherapy? Because for me, neoadjuvant endocrine therapy for me is very interesting if I can figure out a way to use it confidently and forego chemotherapy. If I'm just talking about sequencing, I'm less clear as a medical oncologist what that is doing for me. And Matt Ellis's work looking at the early response to letrozole by measuring Ki-67 to identify the subsets that maybe will have particularly good response to endocrine therapy. I mean, I think it's a complex set of data to try and fold into one trial, but we're looking at it.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know, woman in her late 60s, strongly ERPR positive tumor, let's say it's under 2 centimeters, sentinel node negative, got a low recurrence score. I mean, I wonder where chemo fits in her treatment.
Yeah, and I think we all do, but in terms of a trial, then if you're going to have a trial for, say, women above the age of 65 and then determine how you're going to treat them based on the result, where's the randomization? What are we going to do, you know, to tease it out? And that's what we're struggling with a little bit.
What about the MammaPrint assay? Is that something that you're utilizing clinically? What's going on in terms of research-wise, or where do you see things heading with it?
I think the MammaPrint data is, again, a very interesting set of data. The difficulty with the assay, of course, is you have to have your surgeons collecting material prior to starting any therapy. we have tended to, I guess, be more pragmatic in what we work on, sort of the assumption that the norm in this country is to biopsy, put it in paraffin, so let's figure out technologies that can help us in paraffin. But I think in institutions where there's a interest in looking at other options, I think that the mammary print is something that I think is very interesting. The difficulty, again, is trying to envision how you could ever try to pull together any sort of head-to-head comparison trials, these sorts of things. So the NSABP at this point is not thinking in terms of doing trials with mammary print.
So let's try to do at least one of your cases. Why don't we try your first one, your 40-year-old woman?
Okay. His first case is a woman who presented at the age of 40 premenopausal for adjuvant therapy of a T2N1A M0 triple negative breast cancer, Nottingham grade 9. She had only one positive lymph node, one of 27 positive. I treated her with TAC for 6 cycles, and then she underwent radiation therapy to her breast. She had very dense breast tissue parenchyma, so we had elected to incorporate breast MRI into her follow-up to monitor her for IBTR. And basically, 3 years after her original diagnosis, her breast MRI showed a 1.5 centimeter left upper lobe lung nodule. PET CT showed that she also had left hilar and subcarinal adenopathy, but no other systemic mets. Brain MRI, though, showed that she also had a 2.8 centimeter right cerebellar met, and she was remarkably asymptomatic for that fairly large lesion. So once we had the workup completed, we elected to excise the cerebellar met and then use post-op radiation therapy to the tumor bed. Our pathology confirmed that she had metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. After she recovered from that surgery, I elected to treat her with a program of paclitaxel, carboplatin, and bevacizumab. I held the bevacizumab until a couple months later because of her brain surgery. I wanted to give a little more time. I tend to use the Abraxane formulation of paclitaxel in patients, I guess because I'm convinced that it does offer advantages in terms of neuropathy. I think neuropathy develops later, and I just am always bothered when I have to stop the paclitaxel formulation earlier than I want to because of neuropathy. The patient isn't getting as much drug as I would like her to get, and she then has this persisting problem that can make subsequent therapies with things like exabepalo more problematic. So I've kind of gone to using Abraxane pretty consistently when possible for metastatic cancer.
Just out of curiosity, is that based more on your clinical experience, or do you think the clinical research data also supports less neuropathy?
I think that the research data suggests it, and since I've been using it, I have less trouble. So I think my clinical experience is supporting what to me was there, at least was suggestive. I mean, it'll be great when we get more data on it, but I think the available data was suggestive, and it's certainly been consistent with my experience. I find that I don't stop for neuropathy with that agent very often at all.
Any sense, and you know, maybe this could be tied into longer use because of less neuropathy, but in terms of efficacy, I had a great chat at ASCO with Mark Sosinski, who was reporting on NAB in non-small cell, and he was talking about all the new theories about tumors as albumin sponges and, you know, back to the old spark, et cetera. Do you buy into any of that? Do you think it might be more efficacious, or we don't know?
Well, I think the correct answer is we don't know, but I think it might be more efficacious. We did a phase 2 neoadjuvant study using the weekly Abraxane followed by FEC, and the things that jumped out was the remarkable lack of toxicity with the Abraxane for 12 weekly doses. We didn't have many delays, very little neuropathy, and our PCR rate was pretty good for that study. Can't remember the number right now, but part of the problem with the study was we included HER2 positive patients, so the PCR rates had to be sort of, you know, broken down a little bit, but it certainly seemed to be as active as paclitaxel, and was clearly in our patients, they tolerate it better than what we have seen with weekly paclitaxel. So for palliation, it's something that I could say I've just gone to.
So she gets treated first time for metastatic disease in March 2008 with, as you said, carbo, nab-paclitaxel, and Bev. Incidentally, what's your take in terms of the efficacy of Bev in triple negative? Do you think it's the same as, for example, ER positive, HER2 negative, or more or less?
I guess I'm not convinced that it's really more active in any particular group of patients. I think it is attractive for triple negative patients because, you know, we have fewer options there, and sometimes we do see the very nice responses that don't last very long. And one of the things that I think Bev has done consistently is it increases response rate and then time to progression. There's still the conundrum about then why not survival, but, you know, and when I'm sitting down treating a patient with metastatic disease for the first time, triple negative breast cancer, I routinely administer the bevacizumab because I think it's particularly important to optimize the chemotherapy, and I view it as a way of optimizing chemotherapy.
So that was more than 2 years ago. Can you bring us up to date?
Yeah, so I mean, she basically, you know, running through things, she had a really nice response. And after three cycles, her PET scan was negative and the lung nodule was just a little 7-millimeter streak. By the time we finished therapy, the chemotherapy 6 months later, all radiographic abnormalities were gone, and we've kept her on the bevacizumab. She did develop a persistent hoarseness that the ENT evaluated, and her cords looked inflamed that we really couldn't explain with any other mechanism. So we talked and we agreed that maybe we would see what reducing the bevacizumab dose might do. And temporarily that resolved the hoarseness. So we've continued her on, it's about 3.5 milligrams per kilogram per week. And she's been able to stay on it and not had any toxicities. And 2 years after she entered the clinical remission, she remains free of evident disease.
Yeah, I've heard about that hoarseness with bevacizumab. Do you think it's kind of like the nosebleed, something about drying or some kind of local thing?
Oh, I think it's definitely a local thing because clearly one of the very, very frequent symptoms that patients get with bevacizumab is the persistent kind of thin, watery rhinorrhea stuffiness. You know, and as I say, in her case, when they looked down, there was some inflammation there. But the cords worked fine, and with reduction in the bevacizumab dose, when they went back, there was less inflammation.
So her hoarseness hasn't come back?
Right.
Wow. So I guess the question is, you know, this lady has a complete response, lasting over 2 years, still on bevacizumab. Why is she and her tumor different than all the other people where this doesn't happen?
Yeah, I mean, she's getting out there, and we, you know, we did not, the lung nodule and the mediastinal nodes obviously were not approached with any local therapies, but nothing's coming back.
So what do you think? I mean, I guess your B40 study soon is going to take a real good look at the tissue and see maybe to come up with some kind of tissue predictors of benefit from Bev. Any sort of thoughts about what maybe is out there? We've heard about SNPs, anything that you think maybe is going to be fruitful to look at?
Oh, yeah, I think so far the attempts to isolate predictors have been very frustrating. I mean, the most interesting I've heard of the SNPs that you're referring to from the ECOG study. But, you know, as far as anything that looks promising, I'm not aware of it. I think we're still on a kind of early fishing expedition studies to try and sort that out. But there are some unknowns here. You know, she did have the triple negative and I gave her carboplatin. Was that critical? Is it the Bev? You know, these are the things where you don't know. You're just happy that she's doing as well as she is.
I guess it's interesting to speculate if and when she does develop progressive disease, what might be out on the table. And I guess now, you know, maybe by the time that happens, a niparib or some other PARP inhibitor might be available.
Oh, without question. Yeah, we would definitely work to get her on a PARP inhibitor trial. And I have been watching her closely because we kind of, you know, she understands that we're not expecting this to be a curative treatment and that at some point we probably will see regrowth of the tumor. So we've been watching her pretty closely when things begin to progress, try and get her over into a trial.